This weekend starts right after this.
As a small business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
America's persistent health problem. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
The nation's growing troubles with teen suicide and mental health appear to have no end in sight. We'll examine why.
San Francisco's housing market is so expensive that some families are forced to live on rickety boats on the bay.
A Vermont man is proving that even as he approaches 100 years old, it's never too late to check something off your bucket list.
Doorbell cameras are not just capturing porch thieves stealing Amazon deliveries, they're capturing animals being animals.
Turns out that the doorbell cameras are capturing animals of all kinds and doing funny things or weird things or surprising things. Many people find it really entertaining to watch them.
Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Needleman on unintended uses for doorbell cameras. She's here in about 20 minutes. The nation's medical system falls far short of meeting the demand for teen mental health services because cases of suicide and psychiatric disorders are skyrocketing. Jane O'Donnell, health policy reporter at USA Today, says this underscores a public health crisis that is already costing Americans billions to fight. She's got a look at new data. Jane, what are we learning?
We have a larger social problem, a social health problem, where people are dying. Everything's going in the wrong direction. We have an increase in overdoses. We have an increase in suicides. We have an increase in alcohol deaths. So we have a situation where people in their who are now adults have mental health issues in many of these cases that were never addressed when they were younger. However, now we know better, and we know that young people need mental health assessments often because they all need assessments because they often need treatment. And if they get it sooner, they're going to live much more productive, happier lives. There just isn't enough treatment facilities, and there aren't enough mental health services providers.
Now that we've recognized that so much help is needed, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure how old you are, but, you know, certainly in the 70s, the 80s, maybe you started hearing about it, but in the 70s, they weren't talking much about depression and anxiety and alcohol and bipolar. I don't even think the term was around back then. But we know this. We know these things. We know what these diagnoses mean for your life expectancy. So something needs to be done about them, but we just don't have enough places to deal with it.
Wow. We're speaking with Jane O'Donnell, health policy reporter at USA Today. She's written a piece entitled Teen Suicide and Mental Health, America's Deadly, Costly Problems That Have No End in Sight. And you said, what was the stat, 40% of people who need help are not getting it, go untreated?
Yes, of the young people, and that's, I believe that was teens. So 40% are not getting the treatment. Now, there are a variety of reasons for that. Often there's a lack of education by parents or somewhat of a prejudice against seeking treatment, acknowledging their child might have a problem, a disorder, which is a health issue, not a failing, obviously. And then once you get through that hump, if you can, of getting the parent to acknowledge the child needs to be assessed, there's often very long waits to get them treated. It can go up to 10 years, and then you end up with young people who are often suicidal or become addicted in an early age to substances, various substances.
And those things are connected, right? I think you
said... very much so, yeah. It's about... I mean, I thought it was higher, but I suppose the numbers I saw were like 50% of people with addiction disorders have coexisting substance abuse problems. I personally have never met someone who had been an alcoholic or a drug abuser and misuser, I think is the word, who didn't have depression, anxiety, or some very serious trauma that they were trying to medicate.
With regards to the headline here, with no end in sight, what about progress in the meantime on the march to trying to solve some of these numbers?
Yeah, and there is some progress. It can't keep up. Like, the solutions can't keep up with the increases in the diagnoses. And, of course, the diagnoses don't mean more people are getting depressed. It's just that now we know, and they're being assessed that way. But one of the very most hopeful thing that is having pediatricians, just like general practice doctors, like any of our family physicians, actually do an assessment during a physical and ask the appropriate screening questions to see if a child has thought about hurting themselves, is feeling hopeless, despondent, their behavior's changed. So if that could be determined at an earlier age, that would be a big inroad, and there could be referrals to whatever social services, social workers, psychiatrists, psychologists might be available. But there's a tremendous shortage of psychiatrists, but in some cases medication would work. In some cases there might be group therapy. There's all sorts of possible solutions, but you got to get the kids assessed.
And speaking of that, and your reference to growing up in the 70s or 80s, this chart included in your story about things that contribute most to mental or emotional health issues in children, social media at 29%, right? Something
right.
We never crossed our lips back in the day. It's amazing
right.
like how that has come to be so dominant.
Yeah, exactly. And I also, maybe some young people killed themselves when I was a teenager, but I don't know of any. So yeah, there's the, you might have felt bad at different points in your middle school or high school years that you didn't go to a party, but you weren't constantly bombarded by photos of that
yeah.
party. There's such a competition for, looking your best. And then there's, of course, cyberbullying. As an aside, an esthetician told me the other day she has girls in their early 20s coming in and getting injections, multi-hundreds of dollars worth of injections, because they think there's a line on one side of their face or the other, and they don't look good in selfies. I've heard of young people getting nose jobs because they look too big on selfies. I mean, it's really gotten out of control, and it's important to try to keep kids, try to control young people's social media use however you can.
Thanks, Jane. Jane O'Donnell, health policy reporter at USA Today. 13 minutes now after the hour. On this weekend, time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The businesses of the future are being built today, and Michigan is where they start. Learn more by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity. In the heart of industrial Northeast Ohio, the Democratic Party has lost its voice to speak to people that shower after work and not before work. That's a frustration aired by the recent chairman of the Mahoning County Democratic Party. David Betras feels Democrats are complaining about President Trump's tax returns while voters see the president fighting China to get better jobs. He says the voters don't care about his taxes. New York Times reporter Trip Gabriel says Mr. Trump has a tight bond with voters who were once staunch Democrats, an allegiance as much cultural as economic. Trip, what did you find?
Well, the headline says it pretty well, but it is a region that, used to vote heavily Democratic. It is in transition. It's steel mills closed there. And most recently, the reason I went is that General Motors shut down a major auto plant in Lordstown that used to make the Chevy Cruze. They've laid off thousands of workers in kind of waves since Trump's election. Trump was in Youngstown in 2017, telling folks, the jobs are coming back, don't sell your houses. This is an area that, unlike the rest of the country, where the economy shows a lot of signs of life, the lowest unemployment in 50 years nationally, and even wages starting to rise again. Youngstown, Ohio, and more broadly Northeast Ohio, has not been benefiting from that trend. And so I wanted to see whether the blue-collar voters that have always liked Donald Trump are still with him, and indeed they are.
You get the sense that they are not holding the closing of that Lordstown plant against the president, but maybe somewhat, I guess, applaud the fact that at least he tried to prevent its closing?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, and this is, when you think about it, not that surprising. They blame GM for shutting down the plant. They don't necessarily blame the president, and he gets tremendous credit for, as the Democratic congressman from that area, Tim Ryan, says, punching China in the nose. I mean, they like Donald Trump because he is a battler. He talks about jobs. He talked about jobs there when he was running. He talked about the devastation of globalization and deindustrialization and free trade deals that hurt this part of the country, you know, and the Rust Belt, broadly speaking. And it speaks as well to the tariffs, primarily against China now at this point, that are starting to take a bite on a lot of people's livelihoods, particularly farmers in the Midwest. They, you know, are enduring pain in the short term and willing to do that because they think that the president is out there fighting hard to get them better jobs.
I'm speaking with Trip Gabriel, national correspondent at the New York Times, and he's written a piece entitled, "There's No Boom in Youngstown," a reference to Ohio, but blue-collar workers are sticking with Trump. You quoted more than one Democratic official who said that that party's message is just not resonating with voters there. How come?
They feel like that the only message for this particular voter is a jobs-focused message. And, you know, they look around and they see all the momentum in Washington to get the president's tax returns, lots of talk about impeachment these days, and national Democrats often think that that's what's on voters' minds. It is not what's on voters' minds in a place like Northeast Ohio, and I think we extend that to places like Western Pennsylvania and Southeast Michigan and parts of rural Wisconsin.
What happens over the course of the next, I don't know, say year, you know, ahead of election time? Democrats try to seize that message and make it their own in some way? Because I think you referenced that in ahead of the 2016 election, somebody's message along those lines was ignored, too, in a message to the Clinton campaign.
Yeah, the Democratic chairman of Mahoning County, which is where Youngstown is, I mean, it's the roots are just deeply Democratic. It's hard to exaggerate that. And Clinton, in fact, carried Mahoning County, but just by a tiny percent, a huge erosion in traditional Democratic support there. The Hillary Clinton campaign thought it had a message to blue collar workers. It did not get through. I think the backstory on this is that these are the states that cost Hillary Clinton the presidency, not so much Ohio, but, you know, particularly Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And that's why trying to figure out a way to, if not win back actual people that voted for Donald Trump, that might not be possible in a place like the Mahoning Valley or Youngstown, Ohio, or Northeast Ohio, but to find a message that can bring out another set of voters that did not vote for Clinton in 2016, but would come out and vote Democratic with the right message.
Thanks, Trip. That's New York Times reporter Trip Gabriel. It's 22 minutes now after the hour on this weekend. Glad you could spend some time with us on this Memorial Day weekend. People who own doorbell cameras have found an alternate use for them, even though they were designed mostly, right, as security measures. More from this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
They were meant to catch people taking packages off your front step or to check out who's at your door. But as Sarah Needleman of the Wall Street Journal tells us, some homeowners are using their smart tech to check out other things in the yard. Sarah, what did you find?
That would be mostly wildlife. Turns out that the doorbell cameras are capturing animals of all kinds and doing funny things or weird things or surprising things. And many people find it really entertaining to watch them.
What were some of the animals and stories that you heard in this story?
Sure. Well, I mean, they really range the gamut of, you know, alligators and turkeys and deers, birds. But sometimes it's not so much the animal, what they're doing. There have been cases of just a lizard puffing his throat out right in front of the doorbell, like something you would see out of, you know, a National Geographic video. One gentleman had heard that there was a fox in his neighborhood, but, you know, didn't actually see himself until it crossed his camera. Another gentleman said that his camera, you know, he realized his koi pond was being treated like a free sushi joint by this blue heron that would just come and steal the koi. And he wasn't even that upset. He said he was annoyed by the guy, but he had to admit the guy was a good hunter. So, and another woman saw hummingbirds, babies hatch and watch them grow up, and it was a real pleasure. On the other hand, that sometimes you see scary things, like a snake crossing, slithering across the doorbell. Pretty scary.
So, Sarah, how does this work? Is it something that you can continuously watch, or do you get an alert, or does it change?
A little bit of both.
Okay.
So most of these devices have it set up so if there's motion detected within a certain range, a certain amount of feet that you may be able to control, you'll get an alert on your phone from an app that connects to the camera, and you can go ahead and look at it right there. Or the cameras will record the footage, so some people will watch it in the morning as they're part of their morning routine, look at see what happened the night before and see what animals and you know anything else, of course, have come by. You could also watch it in real time. So right now, you can I can open the app and look outside my front door. Even though I'm in Manhattan and I live in New Jersey, I can see and see what's going on over there.
We're speaking with Sarah Needleman of the Wall Street Journal. Are people wasting time doing this?
Yeah, well, some people find it incredibly alluring. You know, sometimes it's just the mundane that can actually be interesting for when it's your house and your property. So people are checking their cameras whenever they get the alerts, or just in their idle time, they're checking the live feed and seeing what's happening. Some people have gotten really accustomed to certain animals and gave them pet names. So the one woman named her hummingbird Hetty. There was a woman who commented in the article, said she's got a turkey in her backyard that she calls Priscilla. In my household, we have Gary the groundhog. We see Gary quite often. I'm not totally sure if it's Gary every time. It could be one of his cousins or relatives, other relatives, but it is really enjoyable to see these creatures come back day after day to your property. And, they just can be real entertaining to watch.
Have the cameras actually protected homeowners from something?
There certainly have been cases where, indeed, the homeowner caught a package thief on camera. Unfortunately, a lot of times law enforcement can't do very much about it. You might see a face, but they don't recognize who the person is. And these cases are usually smaller thefts, and so there's only so much law enforcement can do.
Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Needleman with this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business. But you don't have to take our word for it. Take Evan Lyles, CEO of Roush Enterprises, instead.
For the people that are involved in product development, there couldn't be more unique and exciting opportunities that are really going to shape the future of the world. It's a really exciting time to be in Michigan.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
Thanks for spending part of your holiday weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, what money is measuring for us. Also, housing in San Francisco is so expensive, some people live on boats. And the veteran who finally got his college degree decades after leaving school for World War II. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Well, the question in the NBA playoffs right now doesn't seem to be who will win the NBA championship. The question seems to be how good are these Golden State Warriors? Analysis from Mitch Albom, co-host of the Sports Reporters podcast from Compass Media Networks. Mitch, Warriors seem hungry, like they're pursuing their first title, not their third in a row.
You know, it's not the same group that won last year. I mean, you don't have Kevin Durant out there. And I think the Warriors have been a fascinating exercise in duality in terms of like dual identities for their team. They're one team with Kevin Durant where they can rely on 35 to 40 points on any given night from him just by dumping the ball in. And they're a totally different team without him, in which they rely on that sort of Harlem Globetrotters weave to get guys open for shots. And of course, they're led by Steph Curry and Klay Thompson. That's the way they played before he got there. So it's amazing that you can have sort of two completely different identities on the single team. But what you're calling, I don't know, urgency or whatever, I think is them just reverting back to the way they played before Kevin Durant, which, by the way, they won a championship
right
with.
Not to heap greatness on them, but is that a sign of how good they are, that they can make really what was a mid-playoff adjustment to lose an all-star and keep rolling? Or is it not a fair comparison because they've got, what, six current or former All-Stars on that roster?
Well, I think that's you're actually saying the same thing in either direction. Yeah, it's a nod to the depth of talent on that team that you can lose a player like Kevin Durant and they can slide into, you know, a team that still looks like they got more superstars than you can ever dream of having. But they do. I mean, you know, Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, and Draymond Green, especially now, and I think Draymond Green, even more than Steph Curry, has been able to expand his game with Kevin Durant out, because the things that you ask a Draymond Green to do, rebound, toughness, keep balls alive, second shots, things like that. Not necessary as much with Kevin Durant. You dump the ball to Kevin Durant, he backs in, he turns around, he hits an impossible shot over a guy. What's a Draymond Green really supposed to be doing? And so you can sort of, you know, fall out of your rhythm. But in the high pace, move the ball around, look for three-point shots that they do without Kevin Durant there, he's a much more integral part. So I have to count him as a superstar is the word, but certainly a star. So they already are deeper without Kevin Durant than most teams. I think they're also, Gordon, very well coached. And to be able to shift to that kind of style of play shows that a coach who knows what he's doing.
That's impressive. We're speaking with Mitch Albom, co-host of the Sports Reporters podcast from Compass Media. You referenced Draymond Green. Is this Draymond Green 2.0? Like, who is this guy right now?
Actually, it's Draymond Green 0.50, because I saw him play this way in college here in Michigan State. And right. That's exactly how he used to play, with energy, with fire, with muscle, with surprising agility for a guy who's as big and thick as he is.
Do the Bucks or Raptors have a shot at the Warriors?
I don't think so. Yeah. No. I think what you're seeing with both of these teams is the growing pains of being at this level. You know, for both of them, this is new, at least this incarnation of them. And I think whoever comes out of this battle, and I'd like to see it be a battle, because I think both of them will benefit from being tested in a 7-game series for next year. Whoever wins will advance, obviously, and get some experience in the finals, and whoever doesn't will know what it's like to almost get there and will come back that much hungrier. But against the Warriors, I think there will be a lot of that, wow, we're in the finals. Hey, we're in the finals. What was that?
Yeah, yeah.
And that was the Golden State Warriors taking 4 games from you. So, you know, I mean, they just did it to a very good Portland team, and I think you heard from the Portland players, there was a lot of that, well, you know, we've never been to this level, no one expected us to get to this level. I think you're going to hear that same kind of stuff from whoever gets there from the East to the final.
Thanks, Mitch. Mitch Albom, co-host of the Sports Reporters podcast from Compass Media Networks. 21 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Thanks for being with us. We make countless decisions, financial and otherwise, with little or no thought to the dollars at stake, like splurging on a piece of art or vacation souvenirs. Those things have meaning that's greater than a price tag. That's not surprising. What is surprising is that when emotional resonance isn't there, we typically default to money as the yardstick for measuring someone or something's worth. What's up with that? Here's Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. John, Jonathan, what did you do here?
So what prompted this, Gordon, was the latest results from what's called the General Social Survey. The General Social Survey has been conducted every year or every 2 years since 1972. And one of the key questions they ask in the survey is, taken all together, how would you say you are these days? Would you say you're very happy, pretty happy, or not so happy? And the results for 2018 just came out, and what they found was that 31% of Americans describe themselves as very happy. Now, here's the interesting thing. You go back to 1972 to the first survey, 30% of Americans describe themselves as very happy. So we've risen just one percentage point over the past 46 years. In the meantime, our after-inflation income has gone up 131%. In other words, we are living more than twice as well as we were 46 years ago, and yet our reported happiness is no happier. So what's going on? Why hasn't money bought happiness? And I think part of the problem is that when we think about the world in general, we think about it totally differently from the way we think about our personal lives. And what I mean by that is when we think about our personal lives, we don't put everything in terms of dollars and cents. We don't say, I like, you know, my son more than my daughter because he earns more money.
Yeah.
But when we get to the outside world, we start putting everything in dollars and cents. We say, oh, that Hollywood star, oh, that entrepreneur, they must be super special because they have so much money, much more money than I do, or they earn so much more money than I do.
Where did this come from? How do we develop this mindset?
I think in many ways it goes back to our hunter-gatherer days. I mean, we may not have been using dollars and cents, you know, 10, 20, 30,000 years ago, but we were always looking for ways to assess the people around us and to do so quickly. Now, when we knew people intimately, trust their own judgment. But when we didn't know them intimately, then we had to go on sort of obvious signals. And the obvious signal in today's society is the amount of dollars that people have.
Hmm. We're speaking with Jonathan Clements. He's the founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. And he's written about the way we don't think sometimes about the dollars at stake in the decisions that we make. And he's looked at this general social survey. I was just thinking, in the past 10 years, say with the explosion of social media, would that 31% of people who are happy number go higher if we wiped out social media completely? Because it seems we compare ourselves a lot or get jealous of others when they post.
That's absolutely true, Gordon. And of course, you know, when we post on social media, we're normally posting the best version of ourselves. You know, nobody, you know, post pictures of themselves cleaning the house and scrubbing the toilets. They post pictures of themselves on vacation. And so we see those pictures of our friends on vacation and say, wow, they have a great life.
Yeah.
Because we don't see the pictures of them cleaning the toilets, we have a less balanced view than we otherwise might. So when we think about dollars and cents, you know, it's not just about people. It's also about possessions. So within our own lives, you know, we have many possessions that have no value in terms of putting them up on eBay or trying to list them on Craigslist, but they are worth enormous amounts to ourselves. You think about, you know, family possessions that have sentimental value. Well, once we start looking at the outside world, again, we default to dollars and cents, and we say, oh, that must be really worth having because it has a large price tag attached to it.
Yeah.
And yet, if we actually had that item in our lives, not at all clear that it would make our lives any better.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Homelessness has become such a big problem in the San Francisco area that waters outside the city are increasingly crowded with people living on makeshift boats. The homeless population floating off the coast of wealthy Marin County, just north of San Francisco, has doubled in recent years to about 100. Wall Street Journal reporter Jim Carlton says the ragtag collection of some 200 barges, sailboats, and other mostly decrepit vessels in which they live and store their belongings is a sign of an affordable housing crisis in California that's being felt especially acutely in the San Francisco Bay Area. Jim, what's happening?
Well, I mean, Gordon, it's crazy. It's there's some really old yachts. There's old sailboats. There are some big, 60 feet long. There's others like 13 feet. They usually have rowboats, and they're out there in the water and you know, in storms trying to row to shore. There's been people drowned. There's sanitation issues because there's no, obviously, bathroom facilities out there. Garbage. And the amazing part of this whole story is this bay is surrounded by some of the most expensive homes in the world. So that's really the juxtaposition.
Goodness. And I presume there are some nicer boats that are getting banged into on occasion by some of these more rickety setups.
Absolutely. And there's some really exclusive marinas all around that area, Sausalito, you know, Tiburon. And you see these rickety boats kind of like out of the third world right next to, you know, multi-million dollar yachts. So, yeah, that's an issue as well. And the boats will come in. The people will take water from the marina. They dump their trash there. So it's really an issue.
Wow. What kind of rules are in place here regarding any of this?
Well, that's kind of the amazing part about this is that there's actually a law that you're not supposed to be, you know, camped out on your boat in a place like San Francisco Bay for more than 72 hours. The problem is enforcement. Some parts of the bay enforce it. Oakland, Alameda, Redwood City, they've all done crackdowns. And as they've done that, they've pushed these boats out to Sausalito and Belvedere, that area. And that agency has taken a different approach. They're a much more gentle approach. They want to work with the boaters. They know they don't have another place to go. So, and that's really infuriating to a lot of the residents.
I'm speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Jim Carlton about his story entitled "Housing in San Francisco is So Expensive, Some People Live on Boats." So to skirt the rules, I mean, can you, in theory, just pull up anchor and float, I don't know, 100 yards away and reset anchor and there your 72-hour clock starts all over?
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, you put your finger on the button. It's a legal gray area, and so yeah, you could do that. One of the big issues out here for the people that live in homes on the waterfront is that these boats are, they have their anchors in the mud, but a lot of these homeless people don't really know much about boating, and so in the Pacific storms that happen every winter, they will break free and just go floating towards the dock of a home in, say, Belvedere, and crash into it. There's one homeowner I talked to in Belvedere who has been crashed into 16 times in the last 19 years. Like every year he gets crashed into by a boat.
It's incredible. Wall Street Journal reporter Jim Carlton. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Even at the age of 99, you can still check things off your bucket list. Lou Pioli of South Burlington, Vermont just proved it by getting a college degree. In 1942, he was studying to be a dentist at Niagara University in upstate New York when he was drafted into the Army. He asked the draft board chairman to let him finish the semester. The chairman thought he was trying to dodge the draft. Of course, the answer was no. CBS News says Mr. Pioli served as a trooper in France and flew in military gliders. After the war, he ended up in the insurance business. But daughter Lou Ann got to thinking a life of service deserved one more honor, an honorary degree. She wrote to Niagara University saying he was proud of his time there, still had his purple freshman tie and beanie, and, quote, personifies the values and exemplifies the mission of the university. A request like that is hard to refuse. So last Monday, at a special ceremony in Vermont, Mr. Pioli got to hold his own diploma, an associate degree, hand-delivered by the provost of Niagara University. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business. But you don't have to take our word for it. Take Patty Poppes, president and CEO of Consumers Energy, instead.
All of the innovation that's occurring around robotics, AI, it's happening here in Michigan. We have chemical companies, we have pharmaceutical companies, we have medical device manufacturers. Michigan is a magnet for innovators and dreamers.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.